A record 6 million people have already voted. Based on the data we have, Democrats are surging past Republicans, and that is why Republicans are trying to suppress the vote. But voters are fighting back in several states. We'll get the latest. Later in the show, we'll discuss a New York Times Magazine feature called Elderly and Homeless, America's Next Crisis. But we'll begin by talking about the foiled plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Last night, she told CNN that she asked the White House to tone down Trump's heated rhetoric months ago, but it just continued. Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing Republican efforts to suppress the vote. Voters are fighting back, and they are voting. A record 6 million people have already voted in 27 states. Based on the data that we have, Democrats are surging past Republicans. Later in the show, we will discuss a New York Times Magazine feature called Elderly and Homeless, America's Next Housing Crisis. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. But first, we want to briefly talk about the arrest of 13 men who plotted to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. According to FBI officials, these men were members of a militia group called Wolverine Watchmen, which is behind a conspiracy to violently overthrow the Michigan state government. And joining us now is David Daly, a journalist, senior fellow for Fair Vote, and author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. I know this is not your area of expertise, but since this broke yesterday, we wanted to just briefly talk about it. Overall, David, what are your thoughts about media coverage? Because we've been doing a lot of shows about the history of white supremacy when the Obama administration put out an extensive report about it. The Republicans really fought back and said, you know, you are going after veterans because veterans were part of that report. And then the Obama administration basically apologized and put it in the drawer and really didn't really talk about it after that. So what are your thoughts about how this is being covered?
You know, this is really yet another example of the sort of false equivalency and both sidesisms that the American media too often uses when staring at real, genuine danger. Here you have what is clearly a bold and well-planned out assault to kidnap the governor of Michigan, to take her to Wisconsin, put her on trial for treason, and potentially execute her. And we should be talking about this as and calling it by its actual name, which is this is an attempted coup. This is an attempt at an armed overthrow of a democratically elected a governor of a major American state. That we are not talking about it clearly. And calling it by its name is malpractice.
So I want to play a clip from Governor Gretchen Whitmer because I haven't heard this anywhere else. She was on CNN last night, and she told Chris Cuomo that she has been asking the Trump administration to bring down the heat for months, and nothing happened. Here's that clip.
Well, in the early days when the president was so furious that I said we need a national strategy, and that's when he started identifying me and leveling attacks and criticism my way, we saw the language online go in a very concerning direction, dangerous, violent. The rhetoric just got incredibly ugly. And on a number of calls with the vice president, I asked that the White House get the heat out of the conversation, take the heat down. And each time they recognized that I had made the request and nothing was ever done about it. And we see now that after months of continuing to throw more heat into the situation, it's culminated into a place where they will not disavow white supremacists, even in the middle of a presidential debate. And you see that people listen and they take this as encouragement. And anyone who fraternizes or encourages domestic terrorism is complicit in it.
So there's Governor Whitmer basically saying that she asked the Trump administration to bring down the heat for months and they did nothing.
It's not surprising, right? They actually did the opposite of nothing. You had President Trump tweeting, "Liberate Michigan." I mean, what does he think is going to happen when he tweets, "Liberate Michigan"? We all remember those horrifying images from earlier in the spring and summer in which you had militias at the state capitol there in Lansing, armed, carrying, you know, essentially assault weapons into the state capitol in Michigan, and clearly doing this as an attempt to intimidate lawmakers, to intimidate elected lawmakers in the middle of a pandemic. There was that a famous photo of an unmasked a man with an assault weapon in the face of a guard at the state capitol. And now we also know that some of the people who were there at the state capitol that day, who were pictured that day, are among those who were involved in this attempted overthrow, an insurrection, a hub, and the reaction of the president of the United States in the face of this tends to be, stand back and stand by, which is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, I was reading a piece in The Guardian from May, and a black lawmaker, Sarah Anthony, said she was so frightened by all of these white militia men that were fully armed that she actually was escorted to her office by armed black citizens. So this is where we are right now, David. I mean, just people are armed to the teeth.
People are armed to the teeth, and they feel the freedom and the ability to take these weapons into the heart of the legislative and democratic process. When, you know, what we saw in the spring is the beginning of all of this. And now what we know is that there are militia groups that are working and strategizing on how to put a governor on trial and execute her. And we continue to be talking about a fly on the vice president's head. We are not covering the right issues.
Well, and this really does connect to voting because a lot of people are concerned, especially in states like Michigan and open carry states, that people might show up to the polls armed.
People could well show up at the poll armed. What we have, well, Michigan is one of the most gerrymandered states in the nation. It is a state in which Democratic candidates have gotten more votes for control of the state house in every year on these current maps, so dating back to 2012, and yet Republicans continue to hold all of the power in Michigan's legislature, even though they have not won a majority of votes essentially all decade. And they have been able to pass laws that have kept the public will of the citizens of Michigan from being enacted into law. And in fact, on a regular basis, whether we're talking about the emergency manager bill that led to the Flint water crisis and the lead poisoning crisis there, whether we are talking about environmental regulations, whether we're talking about labor law, whether we're talking about voting rights, whether we are talking about gun control. Michigan has been under minority rule in its legislature this entire decade because of voting. And as we head into the 2020 election, it is one of the key states. There have already been 2.1 million absentee mail-in ballots requested in Michigan. And Michigan has one of the most restrictive laws in the nation about when these ballots can be opened and processed and counted. It's going to take a lot of time to do that. Some people think it could take more than a week. And what we know is that the President of the United States' electoral strategy involves declaring victory on election night before all of these mail-in votes have been counted. These states could, if they wanted to, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, these states could give their local election officials time to begin the count if they passed a simple law that made that possible. Michigan expanded the count by about 10 hours. It's not enough. We are looking at the potential of chaos if we have the same kind of close election in 2020 that we had in 2016. If it comes down to those same three states once again, chaos could be taken off the table if these states simply pass the law. And the fact that the gerrymandered legislatures of these states will not do that means they are just fine with the kind of constitutional chaos that could ensue on November 3rd and in the days afterwards.
This is directly connected to the piece you recently wrote for The Atlantic called Courts Are Taking Away One of Americans' Best Options for Fixing Voting. You write that in 2019, writing the decision for Common Cause versus Rucho, Chief Justice John Roberts closed off the federal courts as an avenue for addressing partisan gerrymandering. But Roberts insisted the Supreme Court's decision did not condone these excesses. Tell us more about the significance of that decision.
I think it's one of the many decisions on voting rights over the course of this decade, along the 5-4 ideological party lines that have done tremendous damage to our democracy. You can go back to the Citizens United at the start of the decade, and then you have Shelby County versus Holder, which really eviscerated the key enforcement protections of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and really allowed states to turbocharge their efforts to reinstate barriers to the vote that are often, you know, micro-targeted at young people, communities of color, poor people, minority voters. Whether these restrictions involve voter purges or eliminations of days of early balloting or precinct closures or making it more difficult to register new voters, whether these are witness requirements. All of that has been expanding at a dramatic pace over the course of this decade. It's been expanding even through a pandemic. You have right now Republicans in courts in just about every major swing state, and what they are trying to do is to make it more difficult for people to get to the ballot box and to vote in the middle of a pandemic. But the Common Cause versus Rucho decision comes out of a partisan gerrymandering case from North Carolina, in which the Republican lawmaker who was in charge of drawing the maps came right out and admitted what they were trying to do. He said, "We are trying to draw a map that will elect 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats because we don't think it's possible to draw a map that will elect 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats." They admitted exactly what they were trying to do there, which was, you know, dilute votes of Democratic candidates a gut competitive elections and ensure that this purple state, where the actual a breakdown in votes is pretty much 50-50 between Democratic and Republican congressional candidates, that Republicans controlled more than 70% of the seats throughout the entire decade. And the Roberts Court essentially blessed this. They said that partisan gerrymandering was a non-justiciable political issue that had to be addressed through normal politics. And the trouble with that is when state legislatures have been rigged in such a way by the very people who would have to reform the problem, you cannot actually make change in that way. And now the very measures that citizens have been able to use in many cases, in many states, five of them in 2018, for example, they were able to use the ballot initiative to try and reform partisan gerrymandering. And now what you are seeing is that courts, Republican courts, especially in red states, North Dakota, Arkansas, have been going after the initiative and making it more difficult for citizens to use direct democracy as a way to rein in legislatures that have entrenched minority rule.
You've got so many examples in your piece. In Arkansas, with two different amendments, citizens worked to establish an independent redistricting commission and open primaries and institute ranked choice voting. In North Dakota, they looked to strengthen overseas military voting and election audits, open primaries to all voters, and enact instant runoffs. In Idaho, voters wanted to expand funding for public education, but you report one by one, these initiatives have been knocked off the ballots by state and federal courts, and for the most tendentious and technical reasons. So people in very conservative states want voters and citizens to have more control on a number of issues, and yet the courts are saying, sorry, not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the other big example, of course, is Florida, where, you know, voters in 2018 amended the state's constitution, 64% of voters there, to restore voting rights to the returning citizens and folks who had had a felony conviction in their past. 1.4 million people would have gotten their voting rights back. And Florida's gerrymandered Republican legislature essentially added a poll tax on top of this that was not in the amendment as passed by almost two-thirds of the state. They said you have to have all of the fines and fees associated with your case paid off before you can register to vote. Oh, and by the way, we can't actually tell you how much money you owe. You have to figure that out all by yourself. And the courts have backed that up. These additional cases now that we are seeing out of North Dakota and Arkansas and Idaho, a lot of these in one-party states where so many of these districts are drawn to be uncompetitive, the only action, right, is in the party primary. And that means that the legislatures of these states become even more extreme. If the only way you can create change in North Dakota or Arkansas or Idaho's legislature is to beat a Republican candidate in a Republican primary, that is not a recipe for any kind of balanced governing. And these legislatures have really gone very far right in all of these states. And voters are trying to bring them back by making general elections more meaningful again, by opening up primaries, by using ranked choice voting. And what happened in North Dakota, they said that, well, because the constitutional amendment contains the language of a statute, we're going to knock it off the ballot. Except there had been multiple constitutional amendments in the state that had included statutes in the past. This made no sense at all. In Arkansas, what they said was that, well, you have to have initiative signature gatherers they have to go through a background check that our state police does, except the problem is that the state police does not actually conduct those background searches. So it makes it, therefore, impossible to get on the ballot because there is now a requirement that cannot actually be satisfied. And it is a dangerous state of affairs.
Today we are speaking with David Daly, who covers voter suppression in depth. He's a senior fellow for Fair Vote and author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. If you have any questions about what is happening in states across the country, especially battleground states, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. David, you mentioned Florida, and I just want to throw out some numbers here because they're important. 64% of voters there amended the state constitution to restore voting rights to 1.4 million people who had completed their sentence following a felony conviction. But the state's gerrymandered legislature modified the provision to require all fines and fees to be fully paid before regaining the franchise. And we know that a number of groups are raising money. Michael Bloomberg has raised, last I checked, it was around $20 million to ensure that people pay off their fines so they can vote. But this is the kind of thing that you're talking about. The voters said, we should restore these voting rights. And then the gerrymandered legislature comes back and says, no, not until they pay their fines.
And it's not even close, right? 64% of voters in Florida. So it's not a partisan thing. It was, you can't get 64% of people in Florida to back an amendment if it is a partisan issue. Voters in Florida saw this as a basic issue of fairness in a democracy. And gerrymandered legislators who have entrenched themselves in power, in deeply anti-democratic small d, fashion, saw to it to add essentially a poll tax onto what voters tried to do. They reached back into the ugliest methods of Jim Crow era voter disenfranchisement, and they tacked that on to the amendment that people in Florida passed. It is a disgrace.
Andy, what are your thoughts about the media coverage of this? Because I'm so tired of hearing partisanship divided. Let's just talk about the issues. As you say, so many more people vote for Democrats, but in these gerrymandered districts, the Republicans win, and the people are trying to create change, but they can't because the districts are so gerrymandered. Why are we still in this place? We've had you on for years talking about, you know, what it will take to ensure that the media really dive deeper than just how things are broken and it's so partisan, yeah, to really let people know that this is what's happening on the ground in these states.
This has been broken actively and intentionally by one of our two major political parties. This is not an accident. We're not in this position by mistake. You've had, there is a long and ugly tradition of voter suppression in this country that dates back to the very founding of the country. So I'm not trying to suggest that this is somehow new. What I am saying is that it has become intensified over the course of this decade. I think it has become intensified since the election of Barack Obama in 2008, and with the awareness inside the Republican Party that the demographics of the nation were changing in a way that they were becoming younger and less white and less rural, and that Republicans have been working ever since to try to change those rules in order to allow them to govern from the minority. We have now seen, twice since 2000 that the president of the United States that has been elected has not had the popular vote. We see that presidents who have lost the popular vote are now in a position to appoint the majority, a conservative majority of justices onto the Supreme Court. We have seen the anti-small d democratic biases, the structural bias of the U.S. Senate. It has been 25 years almost since Republicans over a six-year period have actually won more votes for the U.S. Senate, but the small state imbalance there has given them a genuine a long-term lock in many ways on that chamber, certainly a big head start. You have seen the gerrymandering that has given Republicans an additional head start in the U.S. House. You have seen the gerrymandering in state legislatures that has created a situation in which 50 million of us now, that's about one in six of us, live in a state in which one or both chambers of the state legislature is controlled by the party that won fewer votes in the 2018 election. This is an infection of minority rule that has infiltrated our system at nearly every level. It's going to take deep and serious and rigorous structural reform to root it out, but we also have to begin calling it what it is, minority rule.
Two more questions before we let you go. Texas has become the latest state in trying to suppress the vote. Last week, Governor Greg Abbott issued a proclamation requiring all mail-in ballots to be delivered in person at a single drop-off per county. Some counties in Texas are very big. CNN's Ed Lavandera had to drive just over an hour in one county to find one drop box, and voters are now suing Texas because of this. Houston is the fourth largest city in the United States. It's in Harris County, and there's just one drop box in the entire county. The U.S. Election Assistance Commission says that local government should have a ballot drop-off location for every 15 to 20,000 registered voters. How significant is this development, and can this happen in other states, do you think?
Oh, it's outrageous. I mean, some of these counties are some of the largest in the nation. They are larger in some states in the Northeast. And one drop box is wholly insufficient. One drop box is especially insufficient at a time in which the administration has waged war on the Postal Service and made so many Americans so nervous that a mail-in vote might not arrive on time. All of this is deeply connected. We wouldn't need so many drop boxes if the Trump administration had not waged war and attempted to slow down the mail. We would not need drop boxes if Republicans and their legislators in so many states would not be in court trying to enforce hard and fast deadlines on receipt of absentee ballots. So what the administration has done, right, is in the middle of a pandemic, they have stalled on the kind of funding that is necessary to conduct mail-in voting in the middle of COVID-19. And then they have eliminated overtime and taken a key processing equipment out of post offices and sorting centers nationwide. And then when officials say, well, let's use drop boxes to collect ballots, they conduct a war on drop boxes. You begin to get the picture here. It's like playing whack-a-mole. Every time reformers come up with a solution to make it easier to vote, the administration and their colleagues inside the party and the state parties have attempted to make it more difficult.
And I just looked it up because originally I thought I had the number wrong, but it was right. Harris County has 4.7 million residents. So in a county of almost 5 million people, there is one Dropbox.
It is absolutely outrageous. Oregon, Colorado, Maryland, New Jersey, lots and lots of states allow voters to use Dropboxes. The administration and Republican parties have gone after them in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Texas. I mean, Harris County, where Houston is located, actually had a dozen Dropboxes that were already set up, and they were forced to take that down to one. We know how close Texas could be. Texas, in many ways, has become the poster child for voter suppression all decade. When the U.S. Supreme Court got a writ of preclearance in the Shelby County decision back in 2013, a court handed down that decision in the morning. Greg Abbott, at the time, was attorney general in Texas. That afternoon, he put into place the strict voter ID bill in Texas that made it possible to vote there with a gun license, but not with a student license. Abbott has enforced the current restriction on absentee voting in Texas. You are allowed to cast an absentee ballot in Texas if you are over the age of 65. If you are under the age of 65, even during the pandemic, the state of Texas has said you cannot vote by mail and use a pandemic as an excuse. You begin to see that this is not an accident. This is an attempt to manicure the electorate, to make it easier for some people to vote and to make it harder for others.
Well, as your recent book shows, voters are fighting back and they're winning. We just got a ruling actually a couple days ago that early voting can start on October 13th as scheduled in Texas. Several Republicans wanted to push it to a two-week period, and the Supreme Court said, nope, it's going to be longer than 2 weeks because of COVID. David Daley, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
David Daley is a senior fellow for Fair Vote and author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. And we're going to continue to follow this in the coming weeks because the election is right around the corner. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Fernanda Santos about her piece in the New York Times Magazine. It's about elderly Americans who are experiencing homelessness during the pandemic. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now I would like to welcome Fernanda Santos to the show. Fernanda is a former Phoenix bureau chief for the New York Times and professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. And she wrote a very important piece for the New York Times Magazine called Elderly and Homeless, America's Next Housing Crisis. Over the next decade, the number of elderly homeless Americans is projected to triple, and that was before COVID. In Phoenix, the crisis has already arrived. Hi, Fernanda. Thank you so much for writing this piece, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first off, what prompted you to look at older homeless people and you know, really tackle this issue for the New York Times Magazine?
You know, it started with curiosity, really. I would be driving around the streets of Phoenix and surrounding suburbs, but mostly Phoenix, and see these men, mostly men, with gray hairs, you know, clearly looking to be in their 50s, some in their 60s, with signs saying, help, I'm hungry, I'm homeless. And I began to think, you know, just as we thinking people do, how could this happen? You know, why is this happening? And is there no help for people who are older and on the streets? And when the editor from the New York Times Magazine reached out and said, do you have a story that you would like to do from your part of the country about COVID, immediately I thought, what is it like to become homeless when you are in your 50s or 60s during a pandemic, you know, to have this layer of complications added to an already very difficult and complicated situation. So I started to look into it, and you know, the result is what you saw in the magazine.
I mean, the numbers are very shocking. And, you know, for those of us who cover these issues, it's been a topic for a long time. And it just seems to be getting worse. Listening to you talk about what you see in Phoenix is very familiar here in San Francisco, but also the surrounding suburbs. When I go up north to visit my family, I see so many more older people on the freeway entrances or the grocery shopping exits, older people with signs, so many more than I saw even 5 years ago. And you cite stats in your piece saying that over the next decade, the number of elderly homeless Americans is projected to triple.
Right. Well, you know, the reason you're seeing more older people is because there is a whole part of the baby boomer generation, essentially the second half of the baby boomer generation, that has been historically made up for a larger share of the homeless population. So back in the 80s, they were in their 20s. They were the people who entered adulthood as on the tail end of recessions in this country. They found a very crowded housing and labor market, housing and labor markets crowded by their generational predecessors. They had more challenges to establish a foothold into life as independent adults. And so, and that those challenges carried with them. So they got jobs that didn't have things like pensions or 401k plans, or the salaries they made were just enough to, you know, get by every month, but didn't allow them to have savings for retirement. So essentially what we're seeing is a whole generation of people who have aged on the streets, not of course necessarily the same people, but all of them members of the same part of the baby boom generation. And the interesting thing about the baby boomers is that we often think of them, or at least I often thought of them as this very successful generation. And it's true that there are many baby boomers who were very successful, who are very successful, but there is this whole other side that we didn't talk about. And what you see in San Francisco is what we see here in Phoenix, what we see in Boston, in New York, in many, many large cities in this country. This is not just a problem of one or two cities. This is a situation that the entire United States is dealing with.
And I appreciate that you bring in historical context here, because so many pieces about homelessness will focus on one person who possibly found housing, which is fantastic, but we really need the historical context. And you write that around the early 80s, the HIV/AIDS epidemic surfaced, crack cocaine hit the street, the drug trade emerged as a choice of desperation for unemployed and underemployed young men and women of color. Violence, addiction, mass incarceration, and other ills brought profound and long-lasting changes to the lives of latter-stage boomers. Yet, despite pressure from so many community organizations, the Reagan administration declined to mount a federal response. Instead, it approved a package that included major cuts to the budgets of a number of social service agencies and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency most involved in programs for the homeless. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, you know, as with everything, there's always a reason, right? You can look at the cases of homeless people individually, or people experiencing homelessness individually, and say, okay, John became homeless because he had a mental illness and it was very hard to keep a job. You know, Mark became homeless because, you know, he was unemployed for a long period of time and went through his savings. But there is at the base of it all, there are factors that contribute to certain people becoming more likely to become homeless than others. Some factors are mental illness, addiction, substance abuse, and so forth. But other factors, such as this one that I explore in the story, are generational factors, historical factors. And so because it's a very popular thing to say, we want to cut your taxes, right? And because it's a very popular thing, it has been a very popular thing to say, you know, I worked hard, therefore you should work hard too. And if you do work hard, you will succeed. One of the first things that many politicians from, you know, the White House on down suggest to cut are these safety net services that exist, food stamps, housing subsidies, subsidies for healthcare. And the result is that we basically start digging, you know, making the little holes on the safety net bigger and bigger, and more people start to fall through. And this that we see today is essentially a result of, you know, 50 years of neglect. When the boomers were born in the 50s and 60s, there was one thing we knew: one day they were going to get old. You know, that's mm-hmm. just a fact. So how do we, if we were as a country surprised in a positive way by the very large number of babies who were born during those times between 45 and 64, 65, then we should have, you know, smart policymaking thinks ahead and says, okay, how are we going to prepare for when these people age? And that's the part of the disconnect happened right there. There was no thoughtful preparation in spite of the work that many researchers have done over the years to impress upon politicians the need to react to that.
You write that nearly one in 10 households include someone age 65 or older that does not have money to buy enough food, more than during the recession of 2007. Six in 10 have more than one chronic health condition, and they're working well into retirement age. And this was all before COVID. Let's talk about one of the men that you profile in the piece. You start by introducing us to Miles Oliver. How did you meet Miles Oliver?
So here in Phoenix, there is a place called Justice Center, which is a day resource center for homeless seniors. So you have to be 55 years old or older to be able to go there and access the service they provide, everything from food, lockers where you can leave your belongings, bathroom where you can take a shower, to a program manager who can help you connect you with programs that can give you access to housing vouchers and so forth. So I thought, you know, this is the perfect place to go. It was the beginning of summer here, officially calendar-wise, because the summer in Phoenix, the heat starts much earlier than June 21st. And I went there and I would just kind of hang out, you know, obviously with permission from the people who run that organization. I would sit under this big tent that they have on the parking lot. I would talk to the program manager, to the executive director, Wendy Johnson, and ask them, do you know anyone who has recently become homeless who comes here? And I was talking to a man who is not even identified in my article. He was a lawyer in Los Angeles, 61 years old, and his life just, you know, he's been homeless since the beginning of the year, and his life really just fell apart completely. Miles walked in to get a bottle of water. And as he was talking to the program manager, she said, look, there's a reporter here. She obviously, the program manager is asking him some questions. And she brought him into this room and introduced him to me. And Miles, you know, wanted to share his story. He was a little bit stunned at first, but then he, you know, he let me sit down with him, spend time with him, go with him, go out with him, and see his car that had broken down and was parked somewhere with a lot of the bags that he had with his clothes and his you know, the things that he owned. So it was kind of, you know, a combination of being at the right place at the right time and luck, which happens often with reporting. But I believe that, you know, if you put the time into your reporting, you do find the people who best represent and most easily represent the situation that you're trying to portray.
You write that Miles, his troubles began in April when he had to choose between making his monthly car payment and paying his rent. And he chose the car based on a logical calculation. Without a car, he could not drive to work, meaning no money for rent regardless. Tell us more about his story.
So Miles is an Army veteran. He came to Arizona from Chicago in the late 80s as a young man. He served in Fort Huachuca. It's an Army post in southeastern Arizona near the Mexico border. And he liked Arizona. Arizona is a place that many people come to retire. It has this great climate especially for older people. It's dry air. There's lots of sunshine. It's hot in the summer, but really, really really nice the rest of the year. And Miles, even as a young man, saw this as a place of opportunity for him. And he came to Phoenix, the state capital and largest city in the state, one of the largest cities in the country, and built a life for him. You know, he had several different kinds of jobs, not ever making tons of money, but he was getting by just fine. When this year began, he was registered as a day laborer at a job site, and he was doing a lot of work, mostly in construction, and also delivering pizza for Papa John's on the weekend. But things, you know, were kind of slowing down at the beginning of the year. Even though we weren't really in full on pandemic mode, he noticed that things were slowing down. At least for him, they did. And when April came along, he just didn't have money. He had a high interest loan on his car. It was a relatively old car for which he paid something like, I believe it was $230 a month, and an $830 rent. And he just couldn't pay both. And you know, the interesting thing is that there was a moratorium in place, an eviction moratorium in place. There still is one in place. But as with many of the eviction moratoria out there, there are specific requirements that people must match, and also some things that they have to do to be able to benefit from the moratorium. And with Miles was a small thing. He had to have written a letter or gotten a letter from someone saying that he made less money because of the pandemic. He assumed that jobs had slowed down because of the pandemic. But the day laborer site where he was registered, the people who run it didn't want to get involved. And Miles didn't know where to go for help. And the eviction process in Arizona happens very quickly. It's a very landlord-friendly state. And so within a few days, Miles was out on the streets. He came home from an outing to find a constable putting a writ of restitution on his front door and the door to his apartment. A police officer was there, the manager changing the lock on the door. And he grabbed just a few items, one of them being his reading glasses, and slept in his car that night.
Mm. How old is Miles?
Miles is 55 years old. He was born at the tail end of the baby boom generation. So he will be 65 in 2030, which is when these projections say that we will see a tripling of the number of homeless adults who are 65 years old or older. And Miles, you know, given when he was born and his age, falls right into this category.
Are you still in touch with him?
I am, actually. I am in touch with him and with Mark Fong, who is another of the characters I talk about in the story. Mark is 60 years old, and he had a very severe depression that caused him to stop working for a long time, about 10 years ago. And that kind of set him up onto a path of financial strain. He always was able to pay his bills, but got sick. You know, we're always sort of like these are the people who are literally one thing away from everything going wrong in their lives.
Right.
And
right.
With Miles, right. He got sick. He had a heart condition, had to get a pacemaker put in. And when he came out, he had no job. he had very little money left, and one thing led to another, and he was homeless. I visited Miles yesterday. I'm sorry, Mark yesterday, and I texted with Miles 2 days ago, asking him, because he just got a job, asking him how things were going. He seemed in good spirits, and you know, happy to have this chance to sort of try to put his life back on track.
You know, we're almost out of time, Fernanda, but I just wonder what it was like for you to put this piece together during this election season when the issues of poverty and homelessness are hardly getting any attention. I hear the words once in a great while from candidates, but like the Poor People's Campaign and Reverend Barber is talking about this constantly and saying, please spend more time on these issues. And it's just not getting much attention from candidates.
And sadly, I don't think it will, you know, and that's one of the greatest tragedies. These are people who, you know, worked hard all their lives. They're still working. They pay their taxes. They believed in the idea and the ideals on which this country is built, that if you put in the work, you play by the rules, you do things right, they will do right by you when you need it, you know. And these are people who are in need and just have no ability to, there's very little need that's available to them. The need is much, I'm sorry, there's very little in help that's available to them. The need is much, much greater than what the system can provide. I worry greatly about the next 10 years. And I also worry in some ways about the millennials, because if you think about it, it was a somewhat similar situation, a very large generation whose first half benefited from good economic times and second half came out, you know, came of age during the housing crisis. So, you know, hopefully we'll be better prepared for them as the year in the years ahead.
Well, thank you for writing this important story. Even though it doesn't get much attention from politicians, it's really our role to continue to talk about this and, you know, elevate good work like yours. So thank you so much for writing this important piece.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
It was a pleasure having you, a pleasure meeting you. Fernanda Santos is former Phoenix bureau chief for the New York Times and professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. I hope you can take some time to read her feature. It's in the New York Times magazine called Elderly and Homeless, America's Next Housing Crisis. Over the next decade, the number of elderly homeless Americans is projected to triple, and that was before COVID. And we are very dedicated to covering these issues. So if you have an angle that you'd like us to address, or if you have a story you'd like to share, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and finding this important story. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. You can find past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.